hi there. Welcome to the Consistent Calvinism podcast, where every once in a while, like, I don't know, maybe once a year or so, we put out an episode. And yeah, thanks to the regular listeners who are still around. Really appreciate you guys. Want to say sorry, as usual, for not putting out much content. Been super busy. Things are going pretty well, though. 2024 is going to be busy as well, although I really hope to have a lot more content out. But we are slowly moving other areas of life into being able to hopefully do this sort of thing full time, maybe in the 2025 and later range. We'll see how things go. Now we're going to do another Twitter fun episode here. I'm going to keep calling it Twitter because Twitter fun sounds a lot better than X fun for a whole lot of reasons. And you know, I don't really like the change that Elon made there, but he had to do something, I suppose. I'm going to keep calling it Twitter. Okay, so that's what we're going to be doing here, because it is a lot easier for me, a lot less time consuming for me to just go through my tweets, make a list, and just start going through them. I do think there's a lot of interesting topics. I think a lot of people enjoyed the last one. Some people might not have. I did a poll, but, you know, this is what we're stuck with right now. And with that said, let's get started. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is something that happened at this point many, many months ago, and that is... Most of the listeners of this podcast are familiar with Tyler Vella of the Freethinker podcast, and he unfortunately has renounced Christianity and his profession of faith in Christ. He has apostatized, so to speak, and just like to give my opinion on the situation. Most of it is pretty predictable and straightforward. Obviously, this is a very depressing news for us Christians to see this happen, and obviously we would pray for Tyler, and I don't think he's going to be in the slightest bit offended by my view of saying, as a Calvinist, that I don't think he was ever saved to begin with. I mean, that's pretty straightforward Calvinism, and I think he would understand that completely. As it says in, you know, 1 John, those they went out from us, that it might be known that they were not truly of us. If they had been of us, they would have remained, etc., etc. Now, Tyler has asked that I make a comment on my opinion on the apostasy passage in Hebrews, specifically probably Hebrews 6. And, you know, I hadn't looked at that one in a while. I know it's a very heavy passage, and there's multiple interpretations of it. There's three primary interpretations of it. And I'm not going to get into that one, because as I started to look into it and start reading and studying about it, it's a far more complicated thing than I want to just get into in a Twitter fun episode like this. So I'll probably make a short episode and just, you know, explain the three major interpretations of the apostasy passage, and hopefully fulfill Tyler's request to comment on those things at a future date. I'm just not going to do it here. But what I did want to say is to get people to understand that this podcast, I really don't want to get into the drama of things and the personal issues, okay? I'm going to make mention of it here because I think it's an important deal. It's a big deal. But at the same time, this podcast and what I'm doing here is mostly about the issues. And I've had people sort of say, well, you know, Tyler started saying some negative things about Jesus and you need to call him out and this and that. And it's like, he already knows that I wouldn't be too happy about those sorts of comments. But at the same time, I'm not going to make this podcast about that, okay? So since I want to keep these things about the issues, I quite frankly, and again, this might upset, I'm guessing it's like a 50-50. Half of you aren't going to be happy with what I'm about to say, but this is just the way it is. I don't really care who is making the arguments, okay? So take Leighton Flowers, for example. This podcast primarily so far has responded to him, but it's not about him. It's about the arguments that he made. That's why I started this podcast. He's making arguments that I think are bad arguments that have answers. And unfortunately, his arguments are gaining sway with large portions of people. And I think that there's answers. So I started a podcast to specifically address those things. But it's not really about Leighton, okay? You know, I don't attack him as a person or anything like that. And so similarly, I think Tyler's a nice guy. I'm sure we'll still be friends. But at the same time, it's not about Tyler. So, I mean, I still have to finish the Serious Vagueness of Provisionism, which was a response to Leighton Flowers' response to an episode that I did with Tyler, right? So you're still going to hear Tyler through this podcast, sort of, when I go to review those clips and et cetera. If that upsets people, there's not much I can do about that. Just don't listen to those episodes. And in fact, I think while Tyler was a Christian, he had some very, very good episodes of his podcast. He had some very, very good debates that he did on Romans 9. Specifically, I remember him doing a very good debate on Romans 9 and open theism. And it's like, am I going to not, again, it's not about the person. Am I going to not recommend good arguments and debates because the person's no longer a Christian? Like, I think that would be the wrong thing to do rather than the right thing to do. Now, again, if your conscience tells you, well, I can't listen to a debate where someone who's not a Christian anymore is arguing from the Christian side, okay, that's on you. But it's not on me. That's not on my conscience, okay? So I don't know what of Tyler's I will, if ever, be recommending again. I don't know, but I'm not going to make a promise that I won't, because I think he's done a lot of good work. And if that upsets any of you, you got to remember, especially as Calvinists, we believe that God can use these types of things, regardless of who is saying them, right? Good arguments can be used to push truth forward in the world. And, you know, that's one of the great things about having something like the internet and being blessed with that, is that, yeah, Tyler might not be a Christian anymore, but he has put out work that God, I assure you, that God will use in the future. And so just, you know, I'm not going to go on any more on this. Once again, we will pray for Tyler. I will be addressing Hebrews 6 per his request in the future. And that's about as much as this podcast will ever stray into the quote-unquote drama of online persons, okay? So let's get into the fun part of this Twitter fun episode. And that is the first tweet we have here that we're going to review is... Again, I don't really think I want to mention too many names unless it's somebody like Leighton Flowers or Provisionist Perspective or something. So I'm just going to say this dude tweeted, a hard pill for Calvinists to swallow is the simple truth that God's will is not always done. Okay, now, he says that Calvinists scream that if God's will isn't done 100% of the time, 24/7, then God isn't God. And so my response to this was a retweet, and I basically said that playing word games is one of the weakest forms of argumentation. The Bible uses the word will in two different ways for God. For example, in Matthew 7:21, in reference to his commands, and in Ephesians 1:11, in reference to his plans and purposes, right? God works all things under the counsel of his will. It's not the same thing as saying, he who does the will of my Father will enter into heaven. So just right there, you have two different uses of the word will. That's not a Calvinist thing, right? That is a Christian thing that everybody has to deal with, okay? And so when we say that God's will is always done, we're referring to the what comes to pass, God's plans and purposes will, okay? That's what we're referring to so clearly. And I have always found this to be one of the weakest arguments against Calvinism. And that is to say, well, it's not God's will that people murder, but they do. And so when you say God's will is always done, you're just wrong and Calvinism's wrong. It's like, no, you have to distinguish between God's commands and what he wills to occur. The clearest case of this is Pharaoh. When God commanded Pharaoh to let the people go, did he want Pharaoh to let, was it God's will that Pharaoh let the people go? Well, according to his command, it was. But what does it also say? I'm going to harden his heart so that he won't. So when it comes to what comes to pass in time and what the plan and purpose God had, was it God's will that Pharaoh let the people go? The answer is no. So that's just one of many examples in Scripture where you have to ask the question, is God planning, purposing, determining, and even bringing about something that is a violation of his own commands? And it's not, is that a contradiction? Well, it can't be a contradiction, right? We have to understand that there's two different usages of the word will. Now, even if we put aside the two different usages of the word, even within the idea of the quote-unquote will of God, spoken of as a single idea of his quote-unquote will, you still have to sort of ask questions, especially more so, I would say, from the non-Calvinist side, okay? So is it God's will that everybody be saved? The non-Calvinist is going to say, well, yeah, of course. Right? And God's actions demonstrate that will. He comes and dies for everybody, according to them, and he sends the gospel to, well, depending on who you're asking, he sends the gospel to as many people as he can, or he also somehow magically sends it through dreams and visions to everybody so that everybody has a quote-unquote chance. But the point here is, guys, is it God's will that everybody be saved? They say yes. But then was it also God's will to give man free will by which he knew millions and billions wouldn't be saved? Well, the answer to that is also yes. So why isn't that a contradiction? Well, let's be fair. It's not a contradiction because you can understand the idea of willing one thing and willing another thing and just asking which you're willing more, right? So I guess, you know, the non-Calvinist is stuck with saying that God willed more that people have free will than he willed that all people be saved. Now, they might reject that or say that's a misrepresentation. I don't know. I'm not talking to one right now. But the point here is, guys, to play these word games with the idea, with words like will, and it gets really bad when they just, I've heard people like Leighton Flowers accuse Calvinists of, well, you're always talking about things in two senses, and so it makes your position, quote-unquote, unfalsifiable. Almost every single time or term or phrase that we are talking about things in multiple senses can be understood that all Christians have to talk about those things in multiple senses. And it's like, I get irritated by weak arguments like this when you're not really, you should filter all of your arguments through your own view first and make sure that it's not something that can be flipped back on you. Okay. That's the message at the end of the day here. Next, we have another tweet from the same person. He says, a Calvinist love to say that sinners are responsible for the rebellion. They love to say that man, because of his fallen nature, is unable to believe in Jesus. What they usually hide is God himself irresistibly determined man's rebellion, fallen nature, etc. And he keeps man that way. Now, I responded by saying that the phrase God irresistibly determined is laughable, okay? So, number one, if God determines all things, including desires, then there's nothing left to be, quote-unquote, resisting. Number two, it shows their view of man as being alongside God ultimately. And number three, what would God resistibly, quote-unquote, determining something look like? In other words, if God is irresistibly determining something, what would God resistibly determining something look like? It's like that adverb, irresistibly, you know, irresistibly determined, is just completely pointless and quite laughable. But the primary point I want to show here, guys, is that so much of the false assumptions from the other side, when you assume that God could either be in control of something or not, right? I consider that a false assumption. And when you make that false assumption, this is where all, like 95% of these objections stem from. And that is that, well, if God's determining something, then as this guy said, he's keeping man that way. He's keeping man in rebellion. And if he would just stop keeping them in rebellion, they'd stop being in rebellion and they'd be saved. So he's trying to paint God as being evil and mean and nasty for keeping them in rebellion. When really, as I've pointed out millions of times before, it's a false assumption that God could either be in control of something or not. As the creator of all things and the sustainer of all things at all moments, it's impossible for something to exist without God being in control of it, right? That's our position. And so that completely undercuts and destroys a whole host of objections. Namely, the idea of irresistibly determining something, like God is forcing it to happen. And if he would just not be forcing it, then other things could be happening. It's like, no, things are happening the way they're happening because the God who upholds all things is working them in that way. He's working all things of the counsel of his will, right? And he is not keeping man in rebellion. He is determining that they continue in rebellion, but they are doing so according to their own desires and their own fallen sinful nature and all these sorts of things. So once again, yes, God determines all things, but how he brings them about is important, and you don't get to ignore it, okay? Because when you do ignore it, you start making these types of misrepresentations. The next tweet comes from the Provisionist Perspective. As usual, he says, the burden is on the Calvinist to provide evidence for why putting your trust in any number of false persons is an ability God gave human beings, but he didn't give human beings the ability to trust in the one true person. So we've heard Leighton make this argument before. I think I even addressed it before in one of my episodes. And that is, well, you're saying that man is born unable to believe in God, but they can believe in all these other false gods, right? And what I pointed out, in fact, I will read my tweet here. I say that for the 1756th time, everyone has the natural faculty ability to believe in God if they wanted to. That's also, by the way, why they're responsible. Responsibility is grounded in the fact that you have the faculty to do it if you had wanted to, but, right? So you weren't being held back from doing something you wanted to do. Rather, because you didn't want to do it, you're responsible, right? And as I say, man's moral inability to believe is a result of their disposition of hatred towards God, which Romans 8 clearly lays out. The mindset of the flesh is hostile toward God, does not submit to his law, indeed cannot. You'll notice Paul himself, right? We talk this way all the time. I can't eat that, right? I can't harm my children because I love them. I can't eat that because I find it disgusting. I can't forgive that person because XYZ, summarized by I currently hate them, right? The disposition towards the thing involved is what results in the moral inability. And moral inability is a reality. It's not something Calvinists make up. As I point out in Genesis, Joseph's brothers hated him. There's the disposition. And they could not speak peaceably to him. They had all the faculties at their disposal to speak. They could speak. They spoke the same language. Their mouths weren't so shut, right? If they had wanted to, if they didn't hate him, they could have spoken peaceably to him. But because of their hatred, they could not. And it literally says they could not. Inability. In Romans 8, it says, indeed cannot. It's the conclusion. Moral inability. It's a real thing. And we talk this way all the time, as I've already mentioned. So, back to the point of the tweet that I'm responding to here. It depends where you're drawing the reference, okay? So, to say that, well, man is morally unable to believe in God, but they're morally able to believe in all sorts of other things, that's actually not true when you're focused on the moral category. Man can believe in anything, including God, if we're talking about the natural faculty of faith, right? As human beings, we possess this faculty of faith that we can use to believe in things, and that includes God, if we want to. That's the key phrase there, right? But let's now talk about moral ability. When it comes to moral ability, you might not necessarily be able to believe in the other things, those other false quote-unquote gods, right? Ask yourself a question. Can a Mormon who believes in the God of Mormonism believe in the God of Islam or Christianity for that matter? Well, while they're Mormons and while they love the false Mormon God, they cannot believe in the other gods, right? So it just depends on where you draw the reference point. In fact, let's bring this a little closer to home by asking you Christians, us Christians, ask yourselves, while you're a Christian, while you love God, can you believe in false gods right now? Stop and think about that. Can you believe in Allah? Can you believe in the God of Mormonism? Can you believe in the Jehovah's Witness God? Well, if you're honest about it, the answer is no, of course not. Because I love God, I cannot believe in those things right now, right? And when you think about it that way, make it more a little more personal, you'll be able to see that, okay, it depends what the reference point is. It depends, you know, what the person is currently believing in and what those person's dispositions are towards the other things. And again, one of the most common things that I'm doing on Twitter and on these episodes is the critical. Why do I mention it so much? It's absolutely critical to this entire debate, the difference between natural ability and moral ability, right? It permeates so many arguments and objections that come against our position. And I believe it's one of the strongest things that needs to be pointed out. And when it's properly put forth, I don't think you can argue against it. I think it's that important and that strong. It's to, number one, demonstrate the reality that there is this thing called moral ability, that we speak in this way. We say that we cannot do things that we actually could do if we wanted to. We talk that way all the time. The Bible speaks that way. It's a reality. And then you properly understand that is what grounds, one of the things, I should say, that grounds responsibility, and why even a Calvinist position can support the idea of God determining all things and still holding people responsible, because the responsibility is grounded in the dispositions that the person has towards the thing. So man is responsible for not coming to God because of their hatred of him. They hate him and refuse to come to him. And so it can be said that they cannot come to him because they hate him. So the next tweet comes in the category of means to ends, which we're always bringing up. This person says, responding to James White, who's a Calvinist, obviously, says, a man who believes God has predetermined every action tries to persuade others via argument, right? So this person's trying to point out a supposed absurdity and thinking that, you know, this fatalistic attitude that we always have to deal with and argue against. Well, if God's determined everything, why are you trying? If God's determined everything, why do you fight against evil? If God's determined everything, why are you, you know, why would you worry? Or on and on and on. And the point is that God hasn't just determined the end. He's also determined the means to the ends. So I respond by saying, well, if you believed that God predetermined that people be convinced by argumentation, would you argue? And what's the point here? Like, we don't know the future. We don't know what God has determined. But if God has determined that something be some way, then there are ways that those things come about. So if God has predetermined that somebody changed their views, how is that going to come about, right? I suppose I could think hypothetically he could snap his fingers, right? Is that the way that God regularly operates? No. So if people are going to change their views, what's one of the common ways they do that? Well, through argumentation, through persuasion, right? And so if I don't know the future, But I know that if God has determined that somebody changed their view, then he's also determined how and why, then I will participate in the means to those ends, or at least try, and give argumentation, right? So he's trying to turn my view into an absurdity by saying, well, if I believe that God predetermined every action, why would I try to persuade people? Well, my answer is because my action of persuasion is also part of what's predetermined. So if God's predetermined that people be convinced by argumentation, then that would include my argumentation. Now, wouldn't it? Now, the next tweet comes from Leighton Flowers, Soteriology 101. He's responding to James White, as usual. He says, and he's talking, James White is basically just arguing straight out of Genesis 50, saying, look, God determined that Joseph's brothers sell him into slavery, and then they are also blameworthy for their evil intentions. God's intentions are good. Their intentions were evil. It's a direct parallel. We've been through all that before. And Leighton Flowers says, White is making the same error he did regarding Genesis 50. He claims the brothers are blameworthy due to their evil intentions, all while ignoring the Calvinist claim that God unchangeably decreed those very intentions. I don't know how you can listen to James White, number one, arguing out of Genesis 50 and come to the conclusion that he, quote-unquote, forgot that God is the one determining those intentions, when it's literally the whole point of us bringing up that passage, is that, look, here's something that God determined, right? Here's something that God brought about. What they meant for evil, God meant for good, right? But I'm just going to read my response here. The point here is that it's both and. It's not either or, okay? God determined it and also holds man responsible. Now, the grounding of the responsibility is the intentions of the brothers. But God having also determined the intentions of the brothers doesn't magically remove the grounding of the responsibility. This is one of the major issues I see whenever this responsibility topic is brought up, is people assume that responsibility, human responsibility, is like page 3 of the creation handbook or rule book. It's like, if God wants to create a world and create human beings and hold them responsible, then subheading 3, you know, section A, says you got to give them free will and you can't control what they do. Like, this is absurd. Human responsibility is something that God chose to build into his creation. It's part of what he's determined, right? It's not a rule that he has to play by. So God has not only determined what people will do, he has also determined whether or not they will be responsible for what they do. It's part of the story. It's not a transcendent rule of the story, okay? And the only way to convince people of this, if that's ever going to be done, is to point to the biblical examples like Genesis 50, right? Or Pharaoh. God hardened his heart, determined that he sinned, and then still holds him responsible. And this proves, again, that the responsibility is part of the story. It's part of what God is determining. It's not in contradiction to God's determining. And so this false assumption that's one of the biggest foundational false assumptions of the other side, that in order for God to hold people responsible, he cannot determine what they do. You don't find that anywhere in the Bible. You find the exact opposite multiple times. You find God determining what people do and holding them responsible. And I consider it to be case closed. I also mentioned very briefly at the end here, I say you never once read in the Bible that God had merely used it for good, that he didn't have anything to do with, okay? And this is also very important. The responses of the non-Calvinists, such as Leighton Flowers, to our primary texts, Pharaoh, Genesis 50, Joseph's brothers, the Acts 4, 27, 28, the crucifixion of Christ being predestined, their response to these texts is so weak. And they come along and say, well, God took it and used it, right? He knew it was going to happen, and so he took it and used it for good somehow. None of these verses say that. And in fact, they're not even vague enough to leave that as a possibility. They all talk about God's action, his hand and plan predestined to occur. God intended it for good. God hardened Pharaoh's heart, etc., etc. It's actions of God. And it's literally impossible for you to make these say that God was just letting things roll so that he could use it later on. You never read that language in the Bible, ever. At least that I've been able to find. And I would love to hear an example, right? We've got our examples here, and you're saying, well, God's just using it. What would be your text that you would go to as a non-Calvinist to say, here it is. God saw it was going to happen, chose to let it happen so that he could use it for good. Where does God ever say that he's doing that? Where does the Bible ever say that God did that? I don't see it anywhere, right? It's all God being active in these things. All right, and the next tweet's going to be pretty brief. This person says, this is an example of a non sequitur, right? This does not follow. One, we act according to our hearts. Two, God made our hearts. Three, therefore, God determines all our actions. Now, I'm mentioning this sort of in agreement with this person and what they're saying. It's really not a good argument when I hear Calvinists say, for example, God fashions the hearts of men. And so that's like some sort of proof text that God is in control of the hearts of man. Like, I mean, I would go, like, I could one up that big time by just going to, for example, Proverbs 21:1, where the hand of the king is in the heart of the king is in the hand of the Lord. He directs it wherever he pleases. I think, like, if you're going to go with God controlling the heart, that's the one to go for, not God fashions the hearts. So this person does have a point, but I responded, or I retweeted, and I said, because this is very common, since we're talking about the heart, I said, you left out the part where God's power upholds your heart, which is determining how it will exist at all moments. Once again, they left that part out. And so you guys are always going to hear me make this argument that when God is upholding the universe, that includes your heart, it includes your will, it includes your mind, it includes your emotions, if that's something, you know. You could break all these things down and talk about, well, what is emotion? What's a thought? Is it something that actually exists, or is it a state of the mind? You know, I've talked about that before. That's actually all irrelevant to the overall point that whatever it is that does exist, and whatever it is that exists the way it exists as it changes moment by moment by moment, God's power is upholding it moment by moment by moment, okay? And so, you know, I mentioned I have this syllogism of mine that I've mentioned before. I'm just going to quickly mention it again because I think it's pretty good, and you know, I've had some people interact with it on Twitter, but nothing in my memory stands out as being a very valid critique of what I'm actually getting across here. So we're talking about the hearts and minds of human beings. My argument from God upholding all things, being in control of those things, right? Which is what I'm pointing out is that this person conveniently forgot. So here's my argument. One, God causes the existence of all created things by his power at all moments. Two, the human mind is a created thing. Three, therefore, God causes the existence of the human mind at all moments. Four, God is the ultimate determiner of what his own power causes, right? Five, therefore, God determines the way in which human mind exists at all moments by causing its existence. Six, human thoughts are contingent upon the way in which the human mind exists at a particular moment. Seven, therefore, God determines all human thoughts at all moments by causing the way in which the human mind exists at all moments. Now, there that is. You can take it or leave it. I think it's a very, very solid argument. It's my primary argument at if you're a regular listener of this podcast, you know that that is basically, you could take this argument and apply it to anything that exists in creation and to demonstrate that God is in control of it at all moments. But we're talking about the human mind here. But I go back to number four, because this brings up a very important thing that number four says that God is the ultimate determiner of what his own power causes. One of the reasons I consider God being the sustainer as such a strong argument is when you can get somebody across the table from you and go down this road, the verse, you know, Hebrews 1:3 is in everybody's Bible. Everybody has to agree that, yes, finite things are created by God and they have to be upheld by God, right? If he stops upholding them, they cease to exist, etc. That's how we all stay good little Christians, right? But here's the important point, is to destroy this argument and to just dismantle it. The only way I see doing that is to attack number four, which says that God is the ultimate determiner of what his own power causes, which I, as a Christian, think is a no-brainer. And I think it would be blasphemy to say that something other than God could be the ultimate determiner of what God's power is doing. I think that that's blasphemy. But it's interesting that when I get people across the table from me with this argument, they have to go to number four and say, well, no, actually, God can somehow surrender control of his own power so that libertarian human free will can exist. And you have to do that to get out of my argument here, right? You have to somehow say that God can throw his power out there to uphold something, but do it in such a way that he is not in control of the effects of it. So that the thing that is being upheld can take that power somehow and wield it and use it and be the ultimate determiner of the way in which it's being upheld. I find that to be illogical. I find that to be putting the cart before the horse logically in terms of God's power and something existing, on and on. And I just think it's blasphemous to say that something other than God would be in control of his power and how something is existing. Because we're not even talking about God interacting in time and doing something with his power, you know, in the storyline level of creation. We're talking about the ultimate metaphysical grounding for the existence of something. To say that the thing that is being upheld can determine how it will be upheld, I just think is mind-blowingly amazing. But it shows the lengths that you'll have to go to get around what I consider to be such an incredibly strong argument from God as sustainer. And as I've mentioned previously before as well, you know, if we take, for example, God's initial creation of the universe, God exerts power, things come into existence. Is God in control of exactly the way things come into existence? Well, of course. Why? Because my number four is true. God is the ultimate determiner of what his own power causes. When God first creates, everybody is perfectly fine with saying that God was in absolute control of how everything comes into existence, right? Because there's nothing else that could possibly be determining that. God is the ultimate determiner in that case. Why does that not hold true for each and every step of creation as it unfolds? If God is the one who is causing existence moment by moment to keep things in existence, then why would God not also still be the ultimate determiner of what his own power is causing moment by moment by moment, right? I really do think, that's why I stress it in so many episodes, that this is probably the strongest argument that a Calvinist could ever use to demonstrate God being in absolute control of all things. And I mentioned this attack on number four of my syllogism as, in my opinion, the best chance the other side has to argue against this argument, or to defend against this argument, I should say. We're already past the point of hearing people like Leighton Flowers say that God upholding your existence just means he's giving you air to breathe or food to eat, right? It's like, that is so clearly not what's being talked about in Hebrews 1:3. The context is creation and upholding the entire universe, which includes non-living things. It's not talking about God keeping you alive, although he does do that. And that concept is mentioned in many other places in Scripture. This is far more fundamental than that, right? So we're skipping past all those really bad knee-jerk reactions to my argument onto what I believe to be the best chance they have, which is to attack the number four, that God is the ultimate determiner of his own power, because that's the only way I can see to even have a chance at getting around this. Now, here's I still think it's a bad defense against my argument, or rebuttal, I should say. But this person is saying that Hebrews' use of the Greek word for sustain evokes the image of a vessel bearing persons across the sea. This boat doesn't control what the persons on it do. Now, really quickly, I just go to the definition of the Greek as well. It means to carry, bear, to bring, conduct, lead, or make publicly known. So you do have the idea of conducting or leading and carrying and bringing, sure. But seriously, just stop and think about this. Again, in my opinion, this is like desperation to really get out of what is, in my opinion, very plain. God is upholding the universe. If upholding simply means carrying, you don't actually think that God is carrying the universe around in his hand or something like that, do you? Right? You don't think that God is like, right? That doesn't even make sense. It's clearly talking about the existence of everything that it's right after mentioning that God, through Jesus Christ, made the world, right? Right after creating everything, he also upholds it. Now, I point this out too, and that is that if you consider that God is upholding everything in creation, right? If he is this quote-unquote boat that's just carrying stuff around, well, if it's everything, then you're actually still stuck with God being in control of all things, because he is carrying each part of creation around as it moves around, so to speak. I mean, so my point here is to try to go down this road and say, well, upholding like literally means like upholding something, and like, what if God lets go of it, what would it do? Well, it would just fall, but it wouldn't cease to exist. And I think that the clear teaching of this verse is that if God stops upholding the universe doesn't just fall. Like, where is it going to fall? It ceases to exist. Okay. So I just wanted to bring this up as, you know, another potential rebuttal to my argument and why I don't think it holds any weight. Now, for those on the other side who might immediately sort of react to my argument here, and by just jumping straight to this, well, God is controlling everything, then that just makes us puppets. We've all heard this before. I have a little thread here I want to go through. Perverse perspective is saying, who is ultimately, quote-unquote, in control of our thoughts? Well, I just went over that, but in this thread, I responded by saying, the God who sustains your mind at all moments is in ultimate control. This doesn't mean you don't control your thoughts. It just means that God is in control of your control. Your control is part of creation. It does not transcend it. That's another critical point here, right? Yes, you have control over things, right? If I pick up an object and wave it around, I have control over that object. But God, who sustains all things at all moments, has control over my controlling that object. That's not a contradiction because God is transcendent. It only seems like a contradiction in most people's minds because they view God as alongside man, right? They'll never come out and say that or admit it, but when they think of God controlling things, they view God as alongside man, and so, well, it's either God controlling something or man. When really, if God is transcendent, in control of the entirety of creation at all moments, then whatever control is happening within the creation is under the overall transcendent control of God. So, Previsus Perspective responds by saying, well, if God is in control of your control, then our quote-unquote control, he has control in quotes, is in no meaningful sense ours, but merely an extension of God's. Now, this is just, that type of thinking only comes from people who are viewing God as alongside everything else, right? Does God control the weather? Well, yeah. Does that mean that when the wind blows the clouds, the wind's not controlling the clouds? It's just an extension of God's control? Well, no, of course not, right? But if what Previsus Perspective just said here is true, that if God controls our control, then our control isn't really ours in any meaningful sense. It's just an extension of God's. You just take that and apply it to the other things that God does control, and you'll see how absurd that immediately becomes, right? So just ask the other side, what do you believe God is in control of? And does that then make it an extension of God? It's like this weird, almost pantheistic assumption that if God is in control of something, it's just like an extension of him. It's like, no, God is not the things that he created, but he can control everything that he created, which includes the relationships of things within that creation, which can include one thing controlling another. Okay, so we're talking about meaningful senses of quote-unquote control. I respond by saying meaningful sense is just your opinion. It's meaningful precisely because God is in control. He's the only one who gives actual meaning to anything in the first place. Somebody then responds by saying, so if I understand, you're saying you do have control, but God has control of your control. Yes. Which makes your control more meaningful than it would be if it was merely your control and not also God's control. Do I have that right? To which I respond by saying, number one, to say that your control could exist apart from God's control is as illogical as saying that anything could exist apart from God. We've already covered that with my argument, right? This false assumption that God could either be controlling things or not. And I say, number two, more objectively meaningful. If something other than God gives meaning to something, it's purely subjective. It's because I say so versus because God says so. So this is where we get into the puppets part of this person's interaction here. They say, so in your view, do you see the way God controls us as analogous to puppets, a puppeteer controlling a puppet? Or would you say that there is a substantial difference? I say, no, a puppeteer has, and this is what sort of shocks people the way I go about this, but I do it for shock value and to really drive home a point. And if you consider everything I've said so far with my argument as God's sustainer, it makes sense. I say, no, a puppeteer has far less control over a puppet than God has over his creation. I go on to say a puppeteer must exert force over against something else. The puppeteer, as I've said, it would be alongside the puppet rather than transcending and upholding the existence of the puppet. God transcends that which he upholds, in God all things hold together. This person says, okay, but that seems like it's still analogous to me, but a difference of degree, not category, which I just completely disagree with. It's not a difference of degree. Merely degree. He's saying, well, so you're saying that God is in more control of things, so it's like this issue of scope rather than category. I'm saying, no, it's actually both. Because God is in a transcendent category as the foundation of that which exists, then he can't help but be in control of the things he's upholding. So this person says, so would you say it's possible for a puppet to have any kind of control over its actions if it was conscious but still controlled in the same way? Now, this is where they're moving so far away from the puppet analogy that it's not really a puppet anymore. Right? If a puppet has control over its own actions, then it's not a puppet anymore. If a puppet has consciousness, it's not a puppet anymore, which is what I say. I say, no, because if it was conscious but quote-unquote controlled in the same way as a puppet, then the person doing the controlling would not be in control of their consciousness or their actions. They would be, it would be overridden with external causation. This person says, okay, assume the puppeteer also has full control over the puppet's consciousness somehow. Now is it analogous? And I go on to say, well, it depends on the method of control, right? If a puppeteer's power was a grounding foundation of the existence of the puppet and its consciousness at all moments, then not only is it not overriding the will, but it would cease being a puppet-puppeteer relationship altogether. And so we went on and on a little more in this, but the point here is that they're trying to bring up this idea of puppets, and when I explain the difference between God transcendently controlling things versus a puppeteer alongside a puppet controlling the puppet, exerting force over against the puppet, etc. And the difference between the fact that a puppet doesn't think thoughts or have emotions or make choices literally at all, then they start trying to modify the puppet example by inserting more and more control of the puppeteer, when eventually, and then inserting qualities of humanity into the puppet. And it's like, well, dude, you've just destroyed your own example in the process here. You have self-destructed your own puppet example by moving it so far away from a puppet that it's no longer a puppet. And if your only goal here is to sort of point out that, in my view, God is in exhaustive control of everything, well, yeah, that we've been saying that from the start. And the reason it's not puppeteering and puppetry is all the reasons I've already listed off. God is not alongside us, controlling us the way a puppeteer controls a puppet. We are not puppets because we have minds, thoughts, emotions, consciousness, etc. And God is upholding the existence of all those things, which means that God has far more control over us than we could ever have over a puppet. And that's not to be looked at as a negative. That's actually a positive on God's part. Next, we have another tweet from Provision's Perspective. He's commenting on Acts 4:27-28, or excuse me, I think this particular portion comes from Acts 2. The crucifixion was according to God's definite plan and foreknowledge. I don't have it in front of me. I think it says deliver it up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God. And then he mockingly says, ah, yes, theistic determinism, and then has multiple facepalm emojis as if this is a non sequitur. Now, I'll admit that the Acts 2 reference, just read simply like that, definite plan and foreknowledge, you might be able to say, oh, see, so God has foreknowledge of free will choices and then has a definite plan that involves those things. But that's why we don't really go to that verse as Calvinists. I've heard some mention it, but we go to the Acts 4:27-28 passage, right? Because that's where it clearly says that it's God's hand and plan, not just his plan, but God's hand predestined those things to take place. And those things included the sinful actions against Jesus Christ of Herod, Pontius Pilate, the peoples of Israel, etc. So I respond to this tweet by saying, whose plan was ultimate? Because, you know, let's go to their view. Their view is the crucifixion was according to God's definite plan and foreknowledge. So instead of, ah, yes, theistic determinism, they say, right, so they're saying, you know, that would be an assumption. Well, sure. They're saying, what's their assumption? Whether they realize it or not. Their assumption is, ah, see, free will. We get to insert free will into God's definite plan and say that God made a plan that is a response to free will. So I say, whose plan was ultimate, God's or man's? Who ultimately determined it? God, which would be theistic, or man? Could it have not happened? Where is your articulation of the passage given your view? Because they didn't articulate their view. They didn't say, well, that's not what it means. It means this. They just sort of threw it out there in this mocking way. I said, don't just tell us what it doesn't mean. Tell us what it actually means. Now, it's kind of funny because they responded by saying, again, sort of sarcastically here, convert the Twitter arguments into podcast episodes. It's like, because I guess they saw my previous Twitter fun episode. And then I respond by saying, I need more interaction from you before I can do that. Do you mind articulating your position regarding the passage and the quote-unquote definite plan? And I don't know why they decided to go down this road. They said, we've given you plenty of interaction. Ironically, I've not given more because it seems you've shifted focus to X rather than podcast content. I was going to make a response to you, for instance, but with respect, it didn't seem worth the time since you're not active. Now, I don't know if you guys remember, Drew made a response to a Twitter interaction that we had, and I made a two-hour episode in response to his response. I took the time to do that. Now, I was late to the party. I told him I was going to do it, and it took me many, many months to get there, which, apologies, but I did get around to it. And then, you know, you guys are very well aware of the fact that I don't put out episodes with regularity, and I don't know why he's choosing this point to sort of throw this at me, where since I'm not putting out a lot of podcast episodes, I'm not really worthy of responding to. And really, I saw this as a cop-out. I said, because look, it's real simple. He said, you know, God's having a plan of foreknowledge doesn't equal theistic determinism. I'd ask, well, what does it mean? And he's saying, well, I would tell you, but you're not really active, so no. And I found this interesting also because I've been waiting on Drew's response to my response. Now, I had a two-hour episode. I made it clear in that episode he can cut it up and do whatever he wants. He doesn't have to make a four-hour episode to my two-hour episode, but I find it very ironic that he's going to throw it at me that, well, I'm not very active, so I'm not going to interact with you here, when I'm still waiting on a response from you. So I said, you can't say that until you've made a response, and I supposedly ignore it because I'm not quote unquote active. And notice that's not what's happened. I'm not ignoring a response that Drew's made. I'm still waiting on this response. So I said, at this point, it's just a cop out. I don't mind either way, but where I'm currently active is irrelevant to whether things are worthy of content on podcasts. So aside from this just very strange, I don't know why that just looked like excuses to not give your view on what it means to have something happen according the crucifixion according to God's definite plan and foreknowledge. What does it actually mean? So since we don't have a response here, I'm left guessing, right? God is reacting to the free will choices of man, which would mean that man's choices are actually the ultimate determiner of God's. As I pointed out in past episodes, you can't have it both ways, right? Either God is the ultimate determiner of what man does, or man is the ultimate determiner of what God does. And it saddens me that so many Christians are perfectly okay with man being the ultimate determiner of what God does. If God is responding and reacting to free will, libertarian free will choices, then man is set up as the ultimate determiner of what God does. And it gets even worse when you consider the fact that God, being perfect, is always going to react in, quote unquote, react in the best possible way, right? God has a particular plan that he wants to achieve, and yet free will is in the way. And so if he wants to get the closest he can to that end goal, he's going to have to react in the best possible way. So God is always going to react in the best possible way, which means that God is basically turned into some sort of a robot, because man is the one that's free. Man's the one that's determining, you know, libertarian free will choices, and God is just reacting over and over and over in the best possible way. Where's God's freedom when you stop to think about it? See, when you elevate the freedom of man, you sacrifice the freedom of God. And if you don't like what I have to say here, well, give a response. What does it mean that the crucifixion was according to God's definite plan and foreknowledge? Next, we have another tweet from Provisioner's Perspective. They just provide so much good response material. They basically post a picture of, this is back when the war in Israel started, or Gaza, I should say. Post a giant picture of a building exploding, being bombed, and they say, imagine watching catastrophic world events unfold and believing, yes, this is exactly what God wanted, when and how he wanted it. To which I respond, imagine thinking that God willingly, choosing to allow it, and stand by and watch when he could easily stop it, somehow means God was unwilling that it happened and is a morally superior worldview. So at this point, we're just clashing with opinions, right? But when you start to think through this logically, it's just mind-blowing to me that people think that there are things that are occurring that God in no way, shape, or form wanted or was willing to occur. That is logically impossible for you to conclude when you believe that God willingly chose to allow something that he could have either A, stopped, or B, changed the course of, or C, not created particular people involved so that it never even had a chance of occurring, right? There is 101 trillion different ways that God could either stop or change the course of something so that it didn't happen exactly when, as Provisioner's Perspective says, when and how it happened. And yet God chooses not to do that. Instead chooses to allow it so that it happens exactly how it happens. And so my point in bringing up this tweet is that this is once again just a bad argument that blows up in your face, right? No pun intended, we're talking about buildings blowing up here. This blows up in your face because if God has the ability to stop or change something and chooses not to, then that's a choice on God's part. And a choice is willing, right? It involves the will. So God is willing that he's willing to allow it and have it happen exactly the way it happens, even in your view, okay? Even in your view, that is the way he is willing that it happen. Now, the only way for you to get out of this, or not even get out of it, but really sort of try to wiggle around, is to, ironically, we mentioned earlier in this episode about the whole two wills thing. Well, you're going to have to commit to a two wills thing here, right? Because you can't get around God willingly allowing it to happen exactly the way it does. So if you're going to say he wasn't willing that it happened exactly the way it did, then you have to introduce two wills, don't you? You have to say, well, God was willing to allow it to happen that way, but he was also unwilling for it to happen that way. And then good luck to you on explaining how that's not a contradiction. In my mind, that's as absurd as saying that God stopped something that he was willing to occur, right? If if you pointed to something that God prevented, quote unquote, or stopped, and I would say, oh, he stopped it, but he was also willing that it occur. That's just laughable. It doesn't make sense, right? That's just as laughable and illogical as saying that God didn't stop something that he was unwilling to occur, right? Just as it's the opposite side of the logical coin there. And so the only way to get out of that clear contradiction is to once again address or speak of God's willingness in these things in different senses or different degrees. It's the only way to make any coherent sense out of it. In fact, it just happened to come up next in my list along these same lines as we're talking about, you know, two ideas of this or that, two senses. The same person, people, Provisions Perspective, has another tweet here. How to be confessionally reformed. Become convinced that every truth claim has different senses and that every difficulty or criticism can be assuaged by referencing the corresponding sense. Become well-versed in asking in what sense and saying in a sense. In this way, your beliefs will seem nuanced and intelligent while being so esoteric as to be completely unintelligible by those not already convinced by them. The goal of this, of course, is to render your beliefs utterly unfalsifiable while setting yourself as the gatekeeper of a standard of understanding no one can reach without full-throated agreement. So basically what they're saying here is Calvinists are always talking about two senses of this and in this sense that. And we've already covered multiple examples of that in just this episode where all Christians have to understand that sort of idea. And I just simply said, once these senses have been defined and articulated, it should be fairly easy to continue the argument, right? If your line of argumentation has anything going for it. So we don't make things unfalsifiable, we just don't let you define our terms for us. So my point here is that we're not talking about things in different senses so that we can somehow get out of quote-unquote problems. We're talking about things in multiple senses because we believe the Bible forces us to do so, with one passage talking about the will of God in one sense and one passage talking about the will of God in another sense. We're talking this way because the Bible forces us to. We can give examples on both sides of these quote-unquote senses. And so I see, ironically, I see this sort of response as sort of a cop-out to actually address those senses. In other words, instead of saying, okay, you've defined two senses, and I'm going to show you why one or both of those senses is wrong by doing X, Y, and Z, instead of going through the effort of doing that, they're just sort of saying, oh, well, you're just playing games and you're not worth my time. And I just think that's weak. I think it's just weak and lazy, right? Let's just grant for a moment that Calvinists have two senses of this and two, three senses of that and five senses of the other thing. So what? If we're defining them, right? If we're actually giving definitions, we're giving biblical support and references to support those senses, then you have something that you should be able to argue against, right? Don't just use this as an excuse to not address it at all. Now, the next quote comes from someone who says that God is love, so he expresses his power not by having to control everything like a dictator or a despot. He adapts his plan for history to the decisions that he sovereignly allows his image-bearing free will creatures to make. Now, this summarizes perfectly the view of 95% of Christianity, right? That free will, number one, free will exists. Number two, God, again, that false assumption I mentioned earlier, God either could control things or not. And so by choosing to not control things, he is not being a big meanie. And number three, that since those first two things are true, God is literally adapting his plans. This person just comes right out and says it. He is adapting his plans for history to the decisions. And it's so funny. I would say that their view has him adapting the plans of history to the sovereign, autonomous, free will choices of his creatures, because, again, as I've already pointed out, you're setting up man as being most free. But he tries to still pay lip service to God here by saying that God is adapting his plans for history to the decisions that he sovereignly allows. Oh, yes, God is the one who's... See, he's still the one in, I guess, you know, he's still God in the upper position of this whole hierarchy of sovereignty, because he's sovereignly allowing, you know, the free will choices. But anyways, I respond to this by saying either, this is very simple, either God's perfect plan includes each and every single quote-unquote libertarian free will decision that ever occurs, libertarian free will decision in quotes there, or God adapted, aka settled, for a less than perfect plan, which this person just blatantly admits. So I'm not really even quoting this person to argue with them. I'm glad they said it so plainly, and I'm just saying, here's your two options, guys. Either God's perfect plan includes every single decision that ever occurs or got adapted and settled for a less than perfect plan. Is there a third option? And browsing through the comments, there's only seven, nobody provided a third option because logically there is no third option. And this is why you can't let the other side get away with saying, well, look, guys, God wanted to give free will, and so this he is really getting what he wants. That is his quote-unquote perfect plan. You can't say that because that would then include, especially in a view, a non-open theist view, where God knows the results of giving man free will, that would include every single free will decision that ever occurred. So you either have to say that everything is his perfect plan or not, right? And the non-Calvinist side, which is constantly saying millions and billions and trillions of things that are happening not according to God's plan, right? You obviously can't say that everything is God's perfect plan. So what do you have? You have a less than perfect plan, okay? As soon as you place God into the adapting, reactionary position, then you have, by definition, a less than perfect plan. And so, you know, I could make an entire episode out of this concept. I'm just bringing this up here so that when you know, this guy says it plainly, but not all of them do. God is, if libertarian free will is true, God has to be adapting and settling for less than perfect. And just remember that us Calvinists, we don't have this problem, right? God has a perfect plan that is perfectly accomplished. And if you were to ask, well, could God have done things differently? Well, yes. And then that would have been his perfect plan, right? Because we have God actively, as the author of all things, actively determining things, okay? So however it is God decided to do things, that is what is perfect. That's why it's perfect. And as soon as you place God into the reactionary position, that is when you begin to undercut his freedom, undercut his purposes, and it's all downhill from there. Now, lastly, I just once again mentioned, don't get confused by God's interactions in time. The difference between that and what we're talking about here. We're talking about God's ultimate eternal purposes, right? One side has God active, the other side has God reactive. And if you're going to ask the Calvinist, well, how do you deal with when God says, if you do this, I'll do that, or since you did this, I'm now doing this. Isn't that reactive? Well, in time it is. But God actively planned that would be an interaction that he would have, right? It is one of the means by which he is accomplishing things is to interact with people. It is wrong for you to take an interaction that God has in time and project that backwards into what was going on in his, you know, in his mind, so to speak, in a logical order of what he was planning in eternity past. That's where people go wrong. So in the next tweet here, real quick, this is a fast one. This person says, a question to Calvinists, since you consider yourself as one of the special people chosen to receive eternal life, while God did not choose the vast majority of the rest of the world, do you feel special? Now, obviously, there's sarcasm and sort of mockery involved in that. But I actually just come right out and say in my response, yes, actually, in a non-boastful, very thankful way, yes, we do feel special. And again, I think that is really what the Bible presents, that God has a special people he has chosen, and they're special not because of something in them. They're special, you know, unconditional election is what we believe in. They're special because God has chosen to make them special, right? And so we can feel special in a non-boastful, very thankful way. Now, I also throw in here sort of a flip back to their side, because I said that's like asking, since God created you in a wealthy and bountiful country, unlike the vast majority of other people throughout history, do you feel special? Anybody can answer that question, even if you're not a Calvinist. And I think the answer is, yeah, thank God for creating me, for example, in America in this particular time, rather than in Africa somewhere starving to death, right? Or dying of sickness and disease. Yeah, we feel special. It's just in a non-boastful, very thankful way. As an example, in 1 Peter 2, 9 and 10, it says, but you're a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness, etc. So God calls his people special, like straight up. So is it wrong for his special people to feel special? I don't think so. I think that's perfectly fine as long as it's not the I'm special because of something in me type of feeling special, right? Because that really is the ultimate question, right? God calls his people special. Who made them special? God or themselves? So these types of little jabs sometimes they just don't turn out the way people hoped that they would. All right, one or two more here. We're getting towards the end. This person says, no one here says God chose me because I chose him. Another Calvinist talking point not based in reality. To which I said, God chose me because I chose him is absolutely and demonstrably your view. And I'm specifically talking to a particular person again. I don't want to really mention names. I said that your corporate election view, which this person holds to, and I've argued with this person before on corporate election, your corporate election view explicitly says that God chooses those in Christ, and you first choose to be in Christ, right? So that is directly saying that God chose you because you chose him. And I challenge you to explain how it could be another way. Of course, this particular person doesn't really like responding directly to me. Sometimes they'll just retweet and respond like indirectly that way. But I just think it's funny how some, you know, this can go both ways. But the point here is when you say something plainly and it's really what they believe, but it doesn't sound too good, then their knee-jerk reaction is sort of deny it. No one here says God chose me because I chose him. When that's literally the whole point of corporate election. The whole point of corporate election is that God chose to choose those who would choose Christ, right? God chose that those who choose to be in Christ would get X, Y, and Z, and blah, blah, blah. We have entire episodes on corporate election, but it's literally God chose you because you chose him. That's literally what the view is, and it's not a misrepresentation at all. So that is going to bring us to the end of this Twitter Fun episode number 2. Trust me, I have, you know, I made a giant list and I thought I was going to get through all of it, and it was like maybe a third of it. So that's good news in the sense of there's more to come. So if you've, you know, particular people who I've interacted with, if you're wondering, hey, why wasn't our interaction on there? It's probably because I looked at it as even more important to save for later. So look at it as the bright side. I will get to it. You know who you are. And, yeah, lots of other stuff to come. So looking forward, January is going to be super busy for me. I won't get another one out in January, but I promise in February I will make very good effort to get another Twitter Fun episode out. And we'll just take it from there. So once again, sorry for being so long. I hope this is, you know, giving you guys at least something to sort of get by on and fill your fix for the Consistent Calvinism podcast. You can follow Consistent Calvinism podcast on YouTube, and the Twitter is at the letter C Calvinism, at C Calvinism. And you guys take it easy and remember to stay consistent, my friends.